perspective of the very long formulation of quantum mechanics.
Please. Right. Thank you very much for the invitation. So, as you said, it's about quantum computing from the perspective of de Broglie-Bohm, which isn't perhaps like a normal way we normally look at quantum information and quantum computation. And maybe that's why I don't think anyone has like looked at it before from that particular angle. But this doesn't work.
In the grand scheme of things.
In the grand scheme of things, it's true. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I'm going to use D.
Yeah,
all right. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to talk briefly about the, essentially what do we mean by that speed up. I mean, you probably all know, but just that we're on the same page. And I'm going to present just the simplest possible algorithm, which we're then going to analyze in the context of de Broglie-Bohm theory. Before we come to that, though, I'm going to briefly review de Broglie-Bohm again. Probably too short if you haven't seen it before at all, and probably too long if you're an expert in it. But, well, I hope it's sufficient for the purposes here. Then we're going to come to the actual meat of the talk, which is the quantum computing in de Broglie-Bohm, and I'm going to present sort of two different physical models to analyze that. And finally, some conclusions, and in particular, sort of some more conceptual points that, so essentially where this analysis could go. So quantum computing, well, we're interested in the resources of computation uses, in particular time and memory, and quantum computing is a great one because it allows us to do some very specific types of problems a lot faster. And emphasis here on it's only, as far as we know, a very small area of problems where we can exploit those quantum effects. And I think the sort of most famous area is factorizing very large numbers. Which is used in quantum cryptography, which I think is really the main reason, for example, the US government has put so much money into the field. So here's the central topic, I guess, central sort of issue I want you to keep in mind as we go through the talk. Kind of what aspect of quantum mechanics is it that enables this speed up? You might already think, well, is this really, I mean, how well could we possibly answer that? But we'll see. And so what aspects enable to speed up? In other words, how can we try to explain this possibility of quantum computation? What sets it apart from classical computation? So let's look at a very basic example. It's known as Deutsch algorithm. I'm sure if all met that before, the idea is that we're given some kind of black box. And we don't quite know what it does. What we do know is we can feed in a qubit or a bit or qubit, depending on the talking about the classical or quantum case, in a 0 or 1 state, and out comes a 0 or 1 answer. So we know that this black box implements one of four possible functions, which I've enumerated here, going F0 to F3. So F0 being both inputs come out as 0, and so forth. But we're not told which one of those four functions are implemented by the box we're given. So before we though ask how can we find out, well, let's ask what does it take to specify an answer to questions such as which function is implemented? Now that takes two bits of information because it's four possibilities, so we can't possibly specify with a single bit which function it is. But if we only have a single bit available for our answer, well then we could specify, for example, is f, so that the real function is implemented, in some particular subset of the possible functions. Is it some particular function? Or any other sort of question we can answer with yes or no. So how would we do that? Well, suppose we want to find out what the function f is. So it requires, as I say, two bits of information. We just feed in a zero state, read off the output, feed in a one state, read off the output. And that works both in the classical and the quantum case. So to get those two bits of information, we had to make two one-bit measurements. Similarly, if we want to ask, for example, is f in the subset f0, f1? Well, in that particular case, you feed in a zero state, measure the output, and then it will be sufficient to determine the answer. So we had to do one-bit measurement to get this one bit of information that we were after. But this kind of breaks down in the case of when we ask, is f in the set f0, f3? Which is another way of saying, is it odd or even, or some constant balance, depending what part of the literature you look at, or use different terminology. And we can feed in f0, or we can feed in f1, and neither will be quite sufficient to give us the answer. But classically, we don't have any other possibility. Somewhere in the classical case, well, we need to make two one-bit measurements, use this oracle, meaning the black box, twice, to come to this one bit of information that we're after. But here's where the quantum computer comes in, where we can exploit quantum mechanics to do it with a single measurement. And I'm just going to go through how this works very briefly. So we have a data qubit and a second auxiliary qubit, which gives out the answer in the form of a modulo 2 addition, whereas the data qubit itself remains unaffected. And then if we work through this circuit just before the measurement, the final state will be a product state, and it will be the data qubit of 0 or 1, depending on the particular property of the function we're after. And so then we can do a final measurement on the data qubit to determine what we want to know, namely if f0 is f1, which is equivalent to asking is our function in the set f0, f3. So how do we explain that? Now here are some suggestions different people have made. Richard Yoja said, well, is it entanglement? This was from a paper, I think, from 1998. And there's maybe something to be said in favor of this very non-classical thing. However, notice that here, there's a state at the end is a product state. And in fact, if you analyze what's going on within that black box itself, which I'm going to come to later, then it'll remain a product state there too. So, maybe there's a bit more to it, but maybe it's not quite the right answer either. Another possibility is, by David Merman, kind of wave-like dynamics. There's some good articles in Physics Today that he wrote. And I think this is probably a very good answer, but again, we need to somehow be more precise than that. And the most famous of explanations is that it's many worlds. It's primarily championed by David Deutsch, but also a lot of other many world theorists have sort of taken on board that view. And so the idea would here be that, well, we're not doing one computation, we're splitting our system into several branches of different worlds and compute it in parallel. Sometimes this idea of like quantum parallelism as applied to many worlds, although that word term is also used sometimes without reference to many worlds, so we have to be careful. Yes?
I mean, many worlds is a kind of loaded term.
Yes.
Why not just say path integrals, which is much less loaded and it seems to be
right.
Less,
you could do,
essentially, I mean, should have this, I would guess, have essentially right. The same information and the same explanation.
We could say, I mean, maybe we could sort of have an explanation of path integrals. I think the reason people like many worlds, which is has a more sort of intuitive meaning, which is probably its downfall in the end, I think. Right, that's the thing. It sounds okay with two different worlds, two different computations going on, that somehow we then connect up again. And I don't find this explanation convincing, but it seems to be moderately prominent. Yes?
But a similar observations. So isn't many words like a more poetic term to say what's a wave-like dynamics? So like
well, there's kind of the problem is there are different versions of many world theory. And I want to discuss those a bit more at the end. I'm going to say so far, is many worlds, there's this one idea that, okay, we need connections of world structures, structure in the wave function that's it results from decoherence, which won't apply here. So it's kind of already a bad start. Alternatively, you might say, well, every superposition is two worlds, but then we have this really strong realist assumption that it goes with mathematical terms. I don't think it's very good either. But I want to talk a bit more about it near the end. So, I mean, in order to have this debate at all, what enables this speed up, what we should do is look at all the sort of contending formulations of quantum theory. And so, I mean, by this, I always mean we should to actually really have a fair debate, include, for example, dynamical collapse models in this and ask, okay, what would they look like in the context of quantum computing? Here I'm not going to do that. Here I'm going to talk instead about the Breuer-Bohm pilot wave theory. And I warn you now that I'm not planning to come to some sort of final answer, because that would undoubtedly be overstating the results. Instead, you're trying to come to a fair debate by having looked at it from different angles. That's the purpose. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, it's another possibility, just that it's not a very well-defined question, what explains the speed-up.
In a sense,
it has a speed-up, there doesn't have to be
right.
A thing where you point to.
We want an explanation, which itself is kind of a loaded term, right? What enables this?
Well, there's also the word what, as though we're going to end up somehow with some particular thing.
There's some particular thing.
We
have this quantum theory, which has a lot of different aspects. You can't really separate them entirely. I mean, we don't have a theory that's quantum mechanics, but without entanglement, without something else. So we can't sort of separate them out and look, can we do quantum computing? We can come up with other toy theories, think about those.
Sure.
So I agree that it's perhaps not a most well-defined question. And in fact, at the very end, I'll make a slightly alternative suggestion how to talk about this topic. So let's look at the Breuer-Bohm theory. And here there's some names of sorry.
You gave us one example, but there are other things.
There are lots of other. Oh, sure, yes.
Do you believe that they're all using essentially the same? I mean, is this example enough to look at, or do we look at those others?
I don't think I think we should look at other algorithms. I mean, there are some that work on very similar principles. For example, Grover's algorithm is kind of, you have a black box there also. It's kind of a slightly more complicated, like many-qubit version of this. In terms of the Shor's algorithm, the quantum Fourier transform, and I mean, we should analyze that separately, I think, to actually get the full picture. So, I mean, see this as a kind of a start, right? Or sort of maybe halfway. I mean, depending how many different algorithms are out there that we haven't found yet that might work on different principles. But now let's go and have a brief review of the Breuer-Bohm before analyzing quantum computation in that context. So the two elements in the ontology of the theory, of the formulation, one is the pilot wave, essentially is like a wave, like the wave function lives in configuration space, not a general Hilbert space, specifically configuration space, and obeys what looks exactly like the Schrödinger equation in position space. And in addition to that, we have this actual configuration. And we can think of this often, like it's often called the particle, but I think it's a bit of a misnomer and leads us to make assumptions that aren't quite right. And it's often been, I think, a major reason for confusion in the literature. So this actual configuration is the configuration of the world. And there are open questions there too, how exactly that would work, how we can get to three space from the configuration space, for example. But this actual configuration, if you just ignore those objections for now, is guided it evolves according to this guidance equation, tracing out a trajectory, and this equation is defined through that current, which in standard quantum formulation would be the probability current, although we shouldn't apply this sort of loaded terminology here. Here's a very famous example of what those paths look like for the two slits experiment, and this image was produced much earlier than 2003. They hear that Bohm himself was quite sort of impressed when he saw that as a sort of visualization of what's going on. But so this theory alone, we need to work with it, we need to show that it matches those extremely good statistical predictions we get from the standard quantum formalism. Because here we have an actual configuration going around in the configuration space, and somehow we're meant to reproduce those statistical predictions that have been so well corroborated. So to do that, in the formulation of the theory, we consider a large ensemble of identical systems, so we can have a density function across configuration space of those different actual or obtaining, probably not quite as good a word, just actual configurations. And then we can prove two theorems. The first one is essentially that there is this kind of equilibrium state, or equilibrium state of affairs, we shouldn't use the word state so easily, that says that if this density distribution matches the size squared, then it'll continue to do so. And then there's the second theorem, second part of why we might call this a quantum equilibrium, and this is if an ensemble is not in that set of affairs, then it'll approach that monotonically given certain condition. And an analogy here is, for example, in thermodynamics, you might say, okay, the box of particles, and if they're all in one half of the box, they'll very quickly reach equilibrium and fill out the box, unless they're in some conspiratorial microstate that makes them either maybe just bounce back and forth all in parallel, or maybe all make them all gather up in a corner. Those states are possible, but they require a very specific microstructure. And so it's kind of very artificial, those states. And similarly here, this theorem holds, provided there isn't a similarly conspiratorial microstructure at the bottom of it. So those two together will mean that after some time, if our system is sufficiently complex to sufficiently large, if we don't easily get those artificial this artificial non-equilibrium distribution that won't go to equilibrium, we will after some time have an ensemble that's very close to this quantum equilibrium. But now we want to produce the statistical results from normal quantum theory, which are about measurements. Now, in the standard, say, Copenhagen interpretation, we associate these operators with observables, and that seems the term observable itself raises a lot of questions. It's kind of a recipe, but it's not really a sort of, it doesn't really give us an understanding of what measurement is. I think here, De Broglie-Bohm is much better. It says, okay, measurement is essentially just an interaction between two systems, the system of which we're trying to make a measurement, and some apparatus. And we're going to represent its apparatus by a simple dial. It might move maybe up and down, point to different values. And then this interaction can be very compactly written with an effective Hamiltonian that of the form as it's there. So A is some coupling parameter determining the strength of the interaction. Then Q is the operator that we would normally associate with this observable we're trying to measure in the standard quantum formalism. And then P is the momentum operator of our dial. So we have to give one variable to our measurement apparatus. And in real life, of course, it would be a much more complicated Hamiltonian there because of a very complicated system that makes up the measurement apparatus. It's not just a simple dial with a single, described by a single variable. But this is the effective Hamiltonian there. And then we can prove with that setup that if we're in equilibrium, the theory will exactly reproduce the statistical predictions of Copenhagen interpretation, standard quantum formalism, essentially. So with that all said and done, let's go back to that very simple algorithm in quantum computing. And the first model I'm going to describe here is due to Bell. It uses spin half particles. He didn't do it in the context of computation, but just describe a very simple model to talk about de Broglie-Bohm. And we represent those spin half particles by simple complex two vectors without any spatial dependence. So just, you can think those particles are just fixed in space. In addition, we have a measurement apparatus described by a single variable, as I described above. And initially, it's sort of set at this neutral position, a sort of start, pointing neither up or down. And its wave function essentially is a very narrow wave packet around that. And so we also know that the actual configuration is within, or the projection in configuration space onto the dimension of the pointer that's exactly within that narrow wave packet. And to measure such a particle, the measurement interaction Hamiltonian will be minus igz ddy, minus I ddy being the momentum operator here, and z being the third Pauli matrix.
When you call this Bell model, you mean just the fact that configuration space is the sphere?
We've got to be careful here. The configuration space itself is one-dimensional. It's the pointer configuration space, right? Of those two particles, in standard quantum formalism, we'd say, okay, the Hilbert space is essentially one qubit, it's the Bloch sphere, and then we have, two of them, and so we take the tensor product. Here, we don't extend the configuration state by those, by essentially the sort of Bloch sphere, we don't do that. What we have is that our wave function will be a multi-component object. Which is it's similar, but Bell would say that our spin is not a bearable, meaning there's no actual spin configuration. It's only a property of the wave function. It's not a property of the actual state of affairs. In a sense, we can explain, for example, the Stern-Gerlach experiment. What we measure in the end is positions. And we can show that the wave function depends on the different, it's multiple spin terms, but we don't need to say there is this real configuration that includes spin.
Sure. But why is this called the Bell model? That's
more important. Oh, because as he used it first in the used this to describe various properties of the Broglie-Bohm theory. So, I mean, it's the spin. Sorry?
Thanks.
Yes, I mean, he describes the two. It's all in the 1987 book. This model is particularly simple in the sense that we can just translate our 0 and 1 states directly into 1, 0, and 0, 1 vectors. So we don't have any work to do there. It also means, of course, that our actual configuration, which is it's just in a single dimensional configuration space, it doesn't move because the pointer is not affected until the very end. So all the computation happens in terms of essentially those spin states and the wave functions. So what we get just before the measurement is the two states as we had them before. This time written in terms of those component, those spin vectors instead of abstract zero and ones. But also we have those in this initial pointer distribution. And then when we conduct the measurement, well, the measurement interaction is given as written here. We're measuring the data qubit. This is the Pauli matrix is that part of the two spin vectors. And we can, if you look what the effect is, well, it will just shift the wave packet one direction or the other, depending on the state of the data qubit. And it'll shift it by this 2g epsilon, where epsilon here is the time, if we assign some measurement time and we start it just before and just after by a period epsilon. This is just some convention I've adopted here. And so the wave will have shifted while this interaction Hamiltonian is turned on by that amount, which means that we can then essentially read it off on the dial. How do we know that? Well, we know because that the actual configuration, the distribution of actual configurations in quantum equilibrium is a size squared. So if the whole wave packet is shifted, then we know that the actual configuration is just shifted the same way. But we haven't found any actual trajectories yet, meaning trajectories of the configuration. And as I said, this is a one-dimensional configuration space. It's all very, very simple. And as I already indicated, nothing actually moves until the very end. And at this point, we should maybe already be a bit skeptical. I'm going to come back to that. And we can see this more sort of intuitively because the Hamiltonian is just that it does nothing to the y coordinate. But during the measurement, essentially we do get a non-zero current, meaning we do get a non-zero motion of those particles, which is the whole point of the measurement, by the simple speed of with g moving in the positive or negative direction depending on the state of those final qubit. And that means you have exactly parallel trajectories. Because no matter, this is independent of y, so no matter where we started, where our actual configuration was, within the part of configuration space occupied by the wave packet, it moves with exactly that speed, independent of the variable. So, as I say, this gives us reason to be somewhat suspicious because all the work is done by the pilot wave. The computation, the trajectory, there was no trajectory at all during the major part of the computation. So the only thing those trajectories seem to do is help us to understand the measurement outcome, to make this concrete, to see how the real world, essentially, and particularly the pointer position corresponds to that, the state of those spin states. You know, whether we need this particle to form an explanation, that's in different debate. That's a debate between the different sort of competing interpretations of quantum mechanics. So this is not specific to quantum computing, that it applies to anything. And so the conclusion then, at least as far as we've seen it now, is that, well, the trajectories, okay, or the particle in configuration space helps us to make sense of measurement, but no more so than say with anything that has nothing to do with quantum computing. So the computation itself is completely independent of that. It's just happening inside the wave. It's just happening using the wave function, which here is the pilot wave. But as I say, this was a very simple implementation, if you want to call it that, because we had this immediate translation to spin states. And we had no trajectories at all prior to the measurement. Now, in general, that's not the case. We can think up other implementations. And so now I want to look at a different model. Also, I'm going to try to keep it as simple as possible. I'm just going to look at states in an infinite well. square value to be precise. And here, our particles, our particle has degrees of freedom. So we choose, we won't have two qubits, so we choose a particle in a two-dimensional well. You could equally choose two particles in a well or two particles into different wells. I think this is the easiest to understand how we might implement those transformations that make up the algorithm. To think of it as a single particle in a two-dimensional well. And we use the two lowest energy eigenstates as for our zero and one states. And in particular, we're going to find the look at the trajectories inside that black box, inside that oracle that was given to us. And I think that's kind of the key step in the algorithm. Before and after is only single qubit rotations. So to do that, we have to translate our abstract description into a real world, or in this case, infinite well dynamical example. So to do this, we need to find the evolution inside the black box. So on the top here, the top matrix is the evolution operator. Again, like in abstract form for general function f. Remember, we don't know what f is. It's one of those four functions taking 0, 1 to 0, 0, 1. Maybe we can combine those in this very general, general form up there, where x now is the off-diagonal real Pauli matrix. And delta is just the Kronecker delta. And so we have this, we equate it to what is generated by the Hamiltonian we're trying to find during some time period capital T. And if we work this out, then we come to a conclusion that our Hamiltonian multiplied by the time during which it acts is given, it has that form as it's written there. And so using that, we can then just use that to generate the state of the wave function inside the black box. So these are our states we're using, with associated energies. Our Hamiltonian has a very simple form because we're going to implement this abstract transformations, abstract gates, just by changing the potential inside the well. Then briefly we're going to describe how we might do that, although it's not the key point here. Given that simple Hamiltonian, we can find a guidance equation for our particles, and that is that simple form, which is very typical for any, because many Hamiltonians look like that. And so the speed, or the velocity rather, of the actual configuration is 1 over the mass of the particle, and then nabla s, where s is the phase of the wave function. So how would we do that more physically? Well, here's one way. So to get a rotation generated by Pauli Z matrix, meaning the diagonal one, we can just wait. Because the free evolution, so far we've ignored free evolution, we're assuming it's a much longer time scale than any kind of step in our computation. So this is an approximation, but if we just here decide, okay, we're going to wait a long time, we can generate rotations in the direction up to an overall phase factor, which would have to take into account our initial preparation of the states. And to achieve that, to achieve an x rotation, so rotations of the qubits generated by the x Pauli matrix, we'd use some perturbation essentially to the potential inside the well. And this is just for one qubit. And those two are sufficient, together with overall phase rotations, to generate any kind of single qubit gate that we'd want. But how do we do the two qubit? How about a two qubit case? Well, here's one proposal how we might do that. So this would be the oracle for the case of F2, so one of the odd function, one of the balanced functions. And the way to arrive at those numerical constants is just by essentially solving the simultaneous equations we get by writing out all the different separate matrix elements explicitly. But this is just one way how we do this in practice. It's not crucial so much here. So let's look at some actual trajectories. This slightly hypnotizing picture is just a free evolution. So they just have this sort of oscillatory motion. It's kind of, if you look at any particular trajectory, it's kind of asymmetric. But overall, we get this vector symmetric picture. And the distribution of trajectories here is for quantum equilibrium. Now, if you want to look at the oracle, so initially we feed in a state that's abstractly written as 0 plus 1 state, which will look to result in an ensemble density of that form. Remember, this is quantum equilibrium, so the ensemble density is just the psi squared, and where psi now is the 0 and 1 written in terms of this infinite square well energy states. Now, let's again look at one of the odd functions, because the even ones actually nothing happens. In the odd case, we should end up with something like this, right? This is what should come out as a data qubit. And so using the tools we've just developed before, we can then set up a computational model to work out the trajectories. And here's what they look like. So and here we can see how this essentially matches our expectation. And we can now look at it and say, okay, what have we learned? And while I am not so sure how much we've learned so far to understand the computation, given that we have those trajectories, don't seem to be telling us very much. But there's a final step in the algorithm, which is again the measurement. So here we're measuring the energy. So we could have a instead of minus I ddx all squared, it might have an extra factor of 1 over 2m there, but we can absorb that into the coupling constant. And here, z is the position of the pointer. So we can measure that. And again, the pointer moves, the analysis is very similar as it was in the Bell model. And what we notice is, well, the outcome is entirely determined by the wave function. It has nothing to do with the actual configuration in x and y space. So the motion of the configuration in the z direction, in the direction of the pointer, is completely independent from the x and y. And so we don't need the x and y motion, the trajectories you just found, to actually account for the computation. This is a final remark here. The pointer will not move up and down this time, but it'll move at different speeds and cover a different amount of distance during the period of measurement, depending on the eigenvalue of the minus I ddx operator. So what do we conclude from that? Well, essentially, as I said, we could have completely ignored those trajectories inside the black box and only looked at the measurement. And this would have been enough to account for the outcome entirely, even within the context of de Broglie-Bohm, where we say, okay, the wave function splitting in some form is not enough to explain measurement. We need this actual configuration to be able to say, okay, the pointer is in this or that position. Even in the context of this framework, we don't need to calculate the trajectories of the x and y coordinates, meaning of the motion of the particle inside the well, to account for the outcome, to account for why quantum computation works. So really the question is, but do those have any kind of explanatory value? And I want to leave this open. This is kind of what I say, we need to put all different theories on the table and see what they have to say. Well, this seems to be what Leroy Boehm has to say, at least as far as you've analyzed it, in those models. Now, one thing we haven't talked about is what happens if the sample is in non-equilibrium. So what if we can't equate the ensemble density with psi squared? And then, well, one thing we do notice is that the algorithm is deterministic. We only get one outcome, which means that no matter where we started, where the actual configuration was in configuration space, within the parts where psi, that the wave function is non-zero, we know it'll work. And so even if we are in non-equilibrium, it'll work. Unless, I mean, if you could imagine that the particle starts somewhere outside the box, which I'm not sure how reasonable a sort of hypothesis that even would be. If we exclude those cases, then we know it will work even when non-equilibrium. Now,
why would it, I mean, even if the particle is outside the box?
If it is possible.
Is there a problem then? Like,
there shouldn't be either. I mean, it's just that we might get some very other odd behavior of the particle. I mean, because the wave function is, and because the motion of the pointer just depends on the wave function, really, it will work even then. I mean, it's just that there's this, we don't really know what's happening with the particle out there. We can't, it's sort of ill-defined. Because the wave function is zero, so we can't really define a phase. So it's more a lack of being, it's not that, I mean, if we ignore that part, well, we can still account for the quantum computation, but we simply, the model sort of, I mean, essentially, the model falls down completely if we assume that those cases are possible. So as, I mean, Raphael said at the beginning, earlier on, that what about other algorithms? And in a sense, the first thing you might say is, well, let's go back to Bell's model. Well, Bell's model was very simple translation of 0-1 states to spin. This sort of spin complex vector without any spatial dependence. And it would work just the same for any algorithm. So really, it's not just algorithms that kind of generalize Deutsch's algorithm, say, sort of more general like Deutsch-Yoja algorithm or Grover's algorithm, both these kind of oracles, but anything else, well, if Bell's model is in some form a reasonable model to use, then we can just do this translation, the spin states, and fully account for the algorithm, because at the end we're just measuring some qubits, and we know how to deal with those. Even in other cases, well, we can just work in our abstract language and infer the way our ensemble moves, at least in equilibrium, just by looking at the wave function, looking at psi squared. And then we can look at trajectories for the numerical simulations, but it kind of remains open how far we can really gain an insight from that. I don't want to say we can't gain any insight, but as far as we've seen so far, there isn't really that much more information. So we can't look at those trajectories I showed you and say, oh yes, that's Deutsch's algorithm, or yes, that's Grover's algorithm. But I'm going to leave it open for everyone to draw their own conclusions. So we've seen this very technical description of how we might implement those. As I say, let everyone draw down conclusions. We need to put all the theories on the table to have this a fair discussion of what enables speed up. However, I don't want to sort of finish without making a few more remarks or suggestions of how we might think about those things. So let's just recap that what we said. Most of the work, right, is done by the wave function, or here better be called pilot wave, and it was explicit, very explicit in the case of Bell's model, but even in other models we saw that we didn't need it to account for the outcome. So it's kind of an open question of some explanatory value, but that's for everyone to make their own mind about. And the kind of real power, I think, of de Broglie-Bohm is in its ability to explain measurement in a much more concrete way. And this is, but this is essentially based on a kind of view that it is outside the realm of quantum computations, more general about quantum mechanics. That do we need this extra particle to really account for that we can look at a point of in three space and say, all right, it's pointing up. And for example, an Everettian might say, no, it's somehow destruct different branches of the wave function from which we can have the three world emerge in the decoherent spaces. And whether that's good or not, well, it's like that is a different debate. I think where the Broglie-Bohm is kind of interesting is if we allow for this non-equilibrium, meaning that, say, with a large ensemble of particles and that their configurations individually, large ensemble of similar systems, and their configurations are not, don't match the size squared in the density. Because then, given certain very particular non-equilibrium distributions, we can exploit those for new kinds of gates. For example, we are able to measure non-orthogonal, differential between non-orthogonal states. Precisely without any sort of with less probabilistic error. And those, we might call those kind of measurements, sub-quantum measurements, and we can use those to build some kind of these new gates. Now, what we would need here to make this work, as far as we know today, there's been very little research done on this, is we need a non-equilibrium distribution for our pointer, not for the particle in the box or whatever we're talking about. And in particular, this non-equilibrium distribution would have to be a very densely peaked around a single point, such as of neutral position. It has to be more peaked than the wave function for this kind, those kinds of gates to work. As I say, very little has been done to actually study this in a more systematic way of what's possible. And here's another point that, in particular, regarding the debate between sort of many world proposal of explaining quantum computation and de Broglie-Bohm is, well, if you look at our analysis, and what we found was that essentially the trajectories don't do very much. The work is all done by the wave function, by the pilot wave. So then looking at the pilot wave, well, we have all the structure that one might argue contains those many worlds. And something of that form is known as different arguments of that form have become known as the Everett and denial argument, which is due to David Deutsch and David Wallace in particular. Now, I'm going to sort of take issue with the view a bit here. Firstly, pilot wave theory allows for this non-equilibrium, and this would give us different outcomes, give us different phenomenology. So even though we seem to be living in quantum equilibrium, provided we live in a de Broglie-Bohm universe, so it looks like it might as well just be sort of many worlds or sort of the standard theory of quantum mechanics. Well, actually, it's a different theory because it has much wider dynamics. We're just in this very special state within what's actually possible. The second point about the idea to explain the speed up in terms of many worlds is that, which I briefly alluded to earlier on, is essentially the many world theory claims that the many worlds emerge the structure of the wave function. So we have decoherence, and then we have two branches that are very separate, very macroscopic, a macroscopic superposition. So we don't need to make any assumptions about the existence of words associated with essentially terms in our state as we write it down on paper, but it's in the structure of the wave function. So picked out by the decoherent spaces. But that's simply what's happening here. There isn't any decoherence. We simply have this microscopic superposition. So if we want to try to explain quantum computation in terms of many worlds, then we need to claim that a single, say, spin half particle in a superposition of two different spin states corresponds to two different worlds. So we have this different assumption of this, what we might call eigenvalue realism. I think the term is due to Anthony Valentini. But this is a much stronger, this is a, many worlds are making much stronger assumptions, and therefore it's a much weaker theory. I don't think many Everettians out there say that we should make do without the decoherent spaces. And maybe a final objection we might have is, well, why should we try to explain it in terms of those pseudo-classical worlds? Because what we're doing is we have this zero and one superposition. We say there's one world where it's zero, or whatever that corresponds, whatever physically that corresponds to, and one world where it's one. So one way where this particle spin up, one way it has spin down. So it seems we're trying to reduce this dynamics we have somehow to the language of classical worlds. And I mean, why can't we just accept that we live in a non-classical world where we have these complex objects? These complex objects are just the wave function or pilot wave, if you talk about it for Bohm, are able to evolve in ways, well, that allow this kind of computation. So all that all said, I now, at the end, want to question our initial sort of outset. We said what interested us is why the speed up of quantum mechanics. And I'm saying, well, maybe that's, after all that, not really quite the right thing to ask. So let's look back at Deutsch's algorithm. And we said, okay, if you want to find out, we're given this black box, and we want to know which one of those four functions does it implement. And we needed two bits to specify that. And classically, or in the quantum case, we had to make two one-bit measurements. So we did two bits of measurement to get a two-bit, an answer that's worth two bits of information. Similarly, for particular subset, is f one of this f zero f one, meaning is f of zero equal to zero? Well, it's one bit of information, and we need one bit measurement to find out. But that seems reasonable so far, and the same is true for is f one of f zero and f two. But this kind of broke down when we talked about is f in the set f0, f3, meaning is f of 0 equal to f of 1. But it seems to me that this pattern, where essentially we do a certain number of measurements, certain bits, number of bits worth of measurement, that corresponds to the number of bits that it takes to specify the answer to what we're interested in, it breaks down not for the quantum case, but for the classical case. So they ask, why do we need to somehow compute or measure this excess information in the classical case? The question is not, why is quantum mechanics able to do it? So the kind of final thought I want to end on is, let's ask instead what stops us from getting a one-bit answer to a one-bit, from a one-bit measurement in the classical case. So what's limiting us in the classical case? In other words, not why the speed-up of quantum mechanics, but why the slowdown, or not the speed-up of quantum computation, but why the slowdown of classical computation. And that's where I shall end my talk. Thank you.
have time for a few questions.
So I guess it's another system you could use to implement a sort of a pilot wave theory qubit would be a sort of interferometer where you have two paths going
right.
in, and you have the Dean's plate mirrors the various unitaries. So you have, so your qubit is where the particle is in this path or this path.
Right.
You could have many such systems, so you could have a number of qubits in that way. In that case, also, I guess this is in common with your second example, then the path, the position configuration space would be playing a role, I suppose.
Well, I mean, we could, again, look at the trajectories of, say, if you have two photons, right? We can look at trajectories of photons, but in the end, how do we get the outcome of our, how do we determine the outcome of our computation? Well, we look at some apparatus that has measured the photon.
Well, I was thinking of, say, electrons, because it's
right,
okay. a model of photons and so on.
Okay.
But then the detector will just click where the electron is.
Right, but you could, whether it clicks or not, right? I mean, that's what causes the clicking?
Sure.
There's some kind of variable we can use to describe that, and we can account for the trajectory of the variable, whatever it might be, in terms of the wave function up to that point.
Okay, well, we can have that argument. In any case, where I was going with this question or comment is, it seems to me that the sort of point of view expressed towards the end that what's really interesting is what happens at the equilibrium.
Right.
I think it's right, because if you take the Roy Bohm model at face value, the generic situation is not an equilibrium one.
Right, exactly.
So the really interesting question would be what kind of theory of computation you have there. And then it seems to me that the sort of speed up you get as you have will depend very much on how you implemented your qubits. That in each of the three different, the two models you suggested and the one I suggested, you may get quite different types of computation.
Right.
And I imagine, at least in the case that I proposed, that the particular trajectory of the particle of the total configuration space would play a large role in accounting for the speed up.
Right, I mean, the crucial point would depend on the speed up is the availability of that non-equilibrium. So we could think of like non-equilibrium as a kind of resource, right?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, as I said, as far as it has been studied, we'd need for example, a very narrow, very peaked ensemble. And then, how do we get that? I mean, where do we get it from? And it depends, and it's kind of the crucial point here that then, as you say, it depends on our implementation. Where can we find this kind of non-equilibrium? How can we then exploit it in our setup?
Right. You seem to be suggesting, I think, that really it was only necessary in the sort of point of state at the end.
Right.
Couldn't it make a big difference if you put that you had
right.
your non-equilibrium resource at the very beginning and a particular dynamics your system might then follow?
That's something that has not been studied at all.
Oh.
Right. So with the pointer, I mean, for the pointer, essentially, if you have a narrowly distributed ensemble for the pointer, we know we can do those particular measurements that essentially leave the quantum state undisturbed, very nearly undisturbed. And we can extract information from it.
Right.
What happens in the, this might be just one example, but there are lots of other applications of non-equilibrium of particular types of non-equilibrium. And just sort of to add to that, I think the understanding of non-equilibrium is kind of key to the understanding of the Breuer-Baum as a whole, because if we never find non-equilibrium ever, then there's very little gained from the Breuer-Baum. So really the Breuer-Baum says there is this wider physics out there. And essentially its success depends on whether or not we find it. I mean, I think there are a few papers by Anthony where he suggests maybe sort of very early universe, very early sort of decoupling has left some particles and non-interacting with anything else, and they might be in a non-equilibrium state. Because everything else has interacted too much and has approached equilibrium, or we're too close to equilibrium, that would be detectable. Now, essentially, if it's never found, I give up on Deborah Bone, because never, well, when do I stop looking for it? But I think it should be kind of the sentiment here that the success of Deborah Bone depends on the success of finding on equilibrium.
Have there any other questions? Well, I would have a comment.
Sure.
So I appreciate the work in itself, like seeing how this algorithm would look in the Deborah Bone situation, and also the conceptual intuition that you presented. And I should see what is limiting the classical case as opposed to see what is the power up in the quantum case. But what I can really see is how we can motivate this investigation with the question, how, why is this quantum speed up coming from?
Oh,
but it seems that really, actually the result that you have is more on the negative side, more like is not explaining anything special.
I mean, I'm trying to sort of leave it open, everyone can do their own conclusions from this.
Yes.
But I mean, we look at those trajectories and we ask what new have we gained? What kind of new understanding have we gained? So yes, it is in a sense a pretty tentatively negative result, as it were.
So it seems to me, if I understood correctly, that what works in Bohm's theory here is that it exactly reproduces the standard.
Right. I mean, so
it appeals to the quantum mechanical calculation to achieve the speed up,
right?
Not to the trajectory.
The trajectory, yes. I mean, and then we could sort of anticipate that, knowing that, well, the outcome is just determined, it's just the point that we're looking at, so we don't have to care about anything else. So whether or not we, as I said, whether or not we need to rely on that De Broglie-Bohm ontology to make sense of why we can see the point in a three space moving up or down, that's different. It's a different debate. Like, you can argue about this. You know, can we sort of account for the emergence of the three space world without? But yeah.
But this, in principle, could have been a point in favor of the Broglie-Bohm formulation if you had a more direct, more intuitive explanation.
Right. And actually, when I started out on this, I was kind of hoping to find something like that, but actually, we just see those trajectories, right? And what have we learned? And I think that the real sort of interesting part starts when we begin to look at the non-equilibrium case. It was so possible then.
Another question is, given that this wave function is incredibly, is an exponentially complicated object, another question would be, why isn't quantum computation even faster? And the Broglie-Bohm model does provide an answer for that. It says, well, you can only see one position in configuration space, not, you can't simultaneously at the end monitor all of these things. So perhaps the model does explain that in a way that's clearer than the explanation given in the many worlds.
I mean, here's just to add to that. So I asked Ian, why the slowdown of classical computation? But even if you have quantum computation at disposal, we can find questions we can ask requiring, say, a 2-bit worth of answer, but we can't get to those just with the measurement. So quantum computation doesn't solve us still everything, right? And so we can ask, what limits the speed up, the wide slowdown of quantum computation relative to some other type of computation? I mean, on one hand, we can ask, hey, relative to non-equilibrium, De Broglie-Bohm, but maybe it was in relation to some completely different theory. I mean, can we come up with some physical theory that would enable a computation for anything you want to know in sort of minimum number of measurements? Anything that doesn't achieve that has some kind of slowdown. And we can try to explain it in the terms of quantum mechanics, well, maybe it would be a good way to, using the Bohm, to explain the slowdown of quantum computation with respect to some unknown theory that allows faster computation.
Okay, so if there are no more questions,
I'll
just say thank you again.
Thank you.
So.